Let me tell you, one stress in my life has been during the pandemic, when you're finishing a book where you're like putting yourself out there as an expert on how to talk about hard things, and you also are in a pandemic, and you also keep having the same fight with your husband every 6 weeks or 2 months or so, like, and fight in the same way. It's like, oh, okay.
Hey, y'all, I'm Tommy Tomlinson, and from WFAE in Charlotte, this is Southbound. This episode was a little intimidating for me because I'm interviewing one of the best interviewers in the world. Anna Sale is the host of the podcast Death, Sex, and Money, which time and again dares to talk about the most uncomfortable parts of being human. And by doing that, Anna makes us feel a little less alone. Anna has a new book that goes even further into some of those uncomfortable places. It's called Let's Talk About Hard Things. So Anna and I talked about some hard things. Friendship. Family. How growing up in the South helps define who we are. I learned some things about myself and about Anna Sale. And I think you will too. Here's our conversation. Anna Sale. The New York Times did a profile of you last year, and there's a line in there about how when you were growing up, you were an observer in a family of talkers. So how did you go from there to somebody who not only makes a living by, but is sort of renowned for your conversations?
Well, if you'll notice, the conversations I'm renowned for are not because I'm the one talking. Like, I am good at listening and figuring out when to pop in, which I think is what you really learn when you come from a family of talkers. You, like, are taking it in. You know you're going to have, like, not that many opportunities to jump in and have a moment of, like, you know, guiding where the conversation goes next. So you have to be use those opportunities to their fullest advantage. And I think that trained me well to be an interviewer.
But you're not just listening and you're not just hopping in with another question. You're hopping in sometimes with your own experiences, your own thoughts mm-hmm. about things. At what point did that feel comfortable to you?
I think that took a lot longer. You know, I think I came up in traditional news reporting environments and in public radio where the first thing you learn when you go out with your recorder is, like, don't make a sound while somebody else is talking or you're going to screw up your soundbite. So I learned early on, like, to nod aggressively while someone was talking, but not to interject my own experience or mm-hmm or any of that. It was like, keep the tape clean, and the focus is on the tape I'm trying to get from somebody else so that I can take that back to the newsroom and then write my story around it. When I transitioned from news reporting to making Death, Sex, and Money, which is about a lot more personal stories, I found, oh, I have to play a role in this to model the kind of vulnerability that I hope someone feels comfortable bringing to the show. So, and the why to do it. You know, it's not because we just want to talk about, you know, provocative, personal, private things for the sake of it, but because there, I believe, is like a larger, something really special happens when you create an environment where people are willing to talk about uncertain or, you know, hard moments where they didn't know what to do, and you can hear that, then it gives all of us a little bit more comfort about not feeling certain about a lot of things.
When you go back home, do you revert?
Oh, are you of course.
Are you the observer again?
Totally. Yeah.
But now you're the observer, and everybody else in the family knows how you make a living. And so are they, like, wary around you? Like, oh God, Anna's going to turn this into something?
Well, yeah. I mean, you would have to ask my family how I'm viewed. But I think certainly, you know, I definitely revert in all sorts of ways. Back to sort of listening. But I have honed the ability of just, like, shouting out the loud thing that needs to be said that you're taught when you're a reporter who covers press conferences. So that gets added to the dynamic too. But yeah. I mean, I think, like, I will say, like, just in all seriousness, the thing that I really love about my family and what I grew up with was a real sense of, like, just like curiosity about other people. And so my family is a family of talkers, but, like, you know, my dad was a doctor, and he would come home, you know, and have the most incredible, he didn't talk about anything that he did in the OR or any problem he solved while he was fixing somebody's broken arm. He talked about the retired coal miner who came in and what he said about, you know, his marriage to his wife, or he talked about, you know, the high school athlete who really wanted to play. You know, he just loved people and still loves people. And so I think that's something I got from my family, a real sort of, like, you know, you just want to make a friend every time you go to the store.
I also wonder, you know, I'm similar in that even though I do this kind of stuff for a living, I'm like, I wouldn't even make the top 10 in talkers in my family. And I wonder whether, I know a lot of people who do this sort of thing for a living, I feel like are sort of naturally introverted but professionally extroverted.
Yeah.
And that they become professionally extroverted because they know they want to get out in the world a little bit and a little bit more, and this gives them reason to do that.
Yeah.
Do you feel like that applies to you?
100%. Like, I, much more than an extrovert, I am naturally, like, want to be an A student. Like, that's the kind of person I am. So if it's an assignment, oh, I have to pick up the phone and call all these people and to, like, learn what's going on. Like, and I have to be charming on the phone if they're going to tell me what's going on and want to talk to me. So that has made me more of an extrovert. But it really started because I'm a writerly introvert type person. Like, you have to do the talking to the people to then have the raw materials to sit in front of your computer and say, like, oh, now what is the thing that I'm going to say about this?
Your book starts and returns several times to one of the big points in your life when you got a divorce when you were 30. And there's a scene in the book about midway through where you talk about one of the first things you did after sort of officially splitting with your husband was to call your parents in that first sort of hour after it happened. And you talk about that as a way to illustrate sort of family bonds and what those mean. I read that and it made me wonder, in those first raw hours, who else did you call?
Oh, that's a good question. Let me picture it. I mean, I think it was like, what I remember, I was alone in a studio apartment in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, that I had been sharing with my soon-to-be ex-husband, and he was not home. He was on the road. We were giving each other space, and it was like we decided this was it. And, you know, it's sort of like when something, it was a moment when something that you couldn't tell what's coming, or is this going to, you know, and then all of a sudden it has been said and it's happening. And I just remember it was kind of like calling my parents was the thing. I think I did it even before I sat in the quiet and let it sink in. It was like, this is the way I'm going to, like, be able to inhale and exhale, is just, like, let somebody know that this is happening. 'Cause it feels so big. And it was a wonderful, really comforting call with my parents. It was like, I hope I can give to my kids what they gave to me in that moment, which was just to say, like, we're here and we know this is really hard and we're here, and just repeating that. But after I talked to them, I feel like I don't have any memory of calling anybody else that night. I think then it was probably just laying on the bed, which was, again, in the middle of the apartment because there were no other walls, and just going, like, okay, like, the world is different now, you know, and but I do remember, it's funny you ask, who else did I call? Like, one of the, like, main things that I really got irritated with myself about was in that period of becoming a single person, I realized, oh, I grew up in this big family. I went to college where I lived with roommates and in dorms. And then I lived with this guy that I ended up marrying. And so I had never lived by myself before. And I realized with some embarrassment how uncomfortable I was with quiet and aloneness. And so it became during that first year of not being, of getting divorced. And then I also was meeting this guy who became my second husband, Arthur, and falling in love with him. I remember it becoming a challenge to myself to, like, don't just pick up the phone and call somebody when you have a minute of quiet. Like, try to sit. And it was really hard for me.
What made me think of that was I've been thinking a lot lately about friendship during COVID.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if you have people that have become sort of surprisingly closer to you during the pandemic, and maybe also people who you're surprised have sort of fallen away in this last year or so.
Yeah, and I've been thinking about this a lot because I'm trying to be more intentional about sort of shoring up the friendships that have fallen away. I mean, it's easy to answer the friendships that have fallen away because it's a lot of people who are my sort of like peers and who are in very similar life phases as me, which is, you know, people I went to high school with, college with, who have little kids and jobs, and like there's just not space. There's not been space to do like the friendly phone catch up thing. So I'm trying to do more like when I do take a break and go out for a walk, just to call the friend, and even if it's leaving a message, like just to try to stitch back some of that connective tissue. But I've had one friend who was a close friend before, but just not in the same way. Like I know him through work, and we were sort of like text buddies, and then we became like text during all staff Zoom buddies. You know, we're like, you know, the side conversation, and then we became like, you know, buddies where he sends me, you know, furniture purchases he's considering and trying to decide. It's like smart or not. And I can't remember exactly when, but at some point, like pretty early on in the pandemic, we just started like ending conversations by saying, I love you. And it was probably around the time we lost a colleague who died about a year ago now. And the shock of that and the sadness and the apartness of it all. Like, but I have thought back on like, you know, the friendships who you start saying I love you when before you hang up the phone, like how nice it is. Like it's such a big step, you know, but like then when you do it, it feels really good for me.
The other half of that, of course, is that now over the last year, we've all spent an intense amount of time with the people who are in our inner circle. And I am wondering, I don't know how much that's changed for you and sort of what you and your husband's work life was like before this, but I guess I'm wondering whether this intense together time has sort of exposed any stresses or revealed any surprising delights maybe that you didn't expect before all this started.
I would say both, but let me tell you, one stress in my life has been during the pandemic when you're finishing a book where you're like, putting yourself out there as an expert on how to talk about hard things, and you also are in a pandemic, and you also keep having the same fight with your husband every 6 weeks or 2 months or so, like, and fight in the same way. It's like, oh, okay, well, here's what these fights are trying to tell me that I need to admit in this book about what I'm not good at. Like, I'm not always the best listener if it's not consistent with my narrative about what's happening. You know, I will get defensive in the first 15, 20 minutes of a fight if I'm feeling attacked, and then I'll come back around. And I feel like the thing that I've gotten better at during the pandemic is because of that stress of just the proximity of everything. And also, I'm 40 and my husband's 41, so like layer on top of that, we're both like beginning our midlife crises. And we have children who are almost 2.5 and almost 5, and that's who it's a lot. It's like this powder keg. But the thing that I have learned is like, okay, like I see what's happening in a faster way, so I can metabolize it faster, so I can get to the productive part of the hard conversation sooner. So in that way, I feel like the like pressures have been useful, but it's, you know, it's been hard. It's hard. It's hard.
I want to ask you a nice simple question. When you started doing this podcast, you were, I think, single still then, right?
Mm-hmm.
And now you're married and you have two kids.
Yeah.
How has having children changed your feelings about death, sex, and money?
Oh, that's like really big. I feel like, well, I will say, you know, I worry about my own safety more now as a mom than I did before. And I just think of it in the most simple ways of like, I don't jaywalk anymore. You know, it's like I have a responsibility to show up to parent these little girls. So I take fewer risks. And I also am much more aware of the sort of, this is not an original thought, but the speed of the passage of time. Like it's, you know, when you can see an infant become a walking person in a year, you're like, oh, a lot does happen in a year. So in that way, yeah. And I also, like, I would say, like, the preciousness of grandparents. Like, we, all of my kids' grandparents are healthy and alive, and this last year has been a time of, like, really just being sad about lost time together. So that's a way I think about death in a way that I didn't before I was a parent. Sex, I mean, I write in the book about the weirdness of post-baby sex, where all of a sudden it's like, I don't know. I mean, I carried my kids, so, like, your body is different. Your, like, energy level is different. Like, between the first and the second kid, we're like, oh, my God, who can even think about sex when you have a baby? And then all of a sudden you're like, wait, but we want to have another kid, so I guess we have to think about sex. Like, but it's, like, becomes utilitarian way of, like, so intimacy, like, figuring all that out, you know, is, it's so different than pre-kids for me. Like, it's not like it's, but I found now, you know, I don't think I'm going to have any more kids. So it's sort of getting back to, I don't know, what's important to me right now. I just love cuddling. I just love being next to my husband. That's like I'm so glad I've had that in this year. And money, oh Lord, I live in the Bay Area, and having kids and paying for life has been, like, that has been where all of my postpartum anxiety, like, it all shows up in money stuff, because it just is crazy. It's like, it's, I think about, like, where I'm trying to work and raise a family. It just seems so different from the context in which I grew up, because everything's just so much money. And people have so much money or so not enough money all around here. And it, I find it really troubling. And it makes me feel a real sense of nostalgia and mournfulness for, you know, there's certainly plenty of inequality in West Virginia where I grew up. And it shows up in the geography. Like, I grew up on a hill, and then there's people who live in the valleys who have left. You see it, you feel it constantly. But it didn't feel like this. And I think about, like, what kind of, you know, just how am I going to provide for my kids? How do I want to model how you use money to my kids? And, like, how are they going to make it? That's like, where all my parental anxiety gets expressed, is around money.
I wonder how that has changed over time. Obviously, your life circumstances have changed in that sense, having kids and all that. But also, you've become successful, in at least in terms of, you have a podcast that's doing well. You have a you know, you're well known. You have a book coming out. There's some money involved in that. I wonder, I know it's different because of children, but I wonder if success feels like you thought it would feel.
Oh, that's a really good question because, I mean, there's, I will say for me, when it comes to money, what I thought, if you would have told me when I was starting out at West Virginia Public Radio, that you could actually make money and support a family, and you could make more than your husband, who's an academic, who like went through so many more years of schooling than you did. If you would have told me that, I'd have been like, oh my gosh, that's amazing. You know, that's awesome. But for me, I have found like my sense of anxiety around money hasn't lessened as I've earned more. And I think that's because I have fears about stability, that, you know, now do I have enough? It's like, what if it all goes away? You know, what if there's an earthquake tomorrow and the house falls down and we have to declare bankruptcy and where would we go? You know, I can have some really elaborate catastrophic thinking. But does success feel like I thought it would? I mean, the really cool thing about success in podcasting is that it hasn't changed my social life in many ways that I notice. So I don't feel... I mean, I guess I still sort of get surprised by when I, like, go talk to a journalism class and they, like, know the back catalog of my show. You know, it's, like, it's so awesome. I love... You know, I'll mention a moment and they'll be like, yeah, I heard that. I'm like, oh, that's so cool. You know, so I'm sort of surprised by it because it's not, I don't see people consuming my work, you know? So then when I get a sense of it, it's a delight. What I do love, what's awesome about how my career has unfolded so far is I get to talk about and talk with the people who I'm interested in. And do stuff that I feel like is meaningful. And that feels amazing.
When we come back, Anna Sale talks about leaving West Virginia for college and how she made sure everyone knew where she came from.
Wait, no one can tell that there's something about me that's different and distinctive and special. And it's about where I'm from. And you can't tell by looking at me. So I'm going to wear, you know, Mountaineer t-shirts and belt buckles.
That and more ahead on Southbound. Those of you who've been following Southbound for a while might remember my podcast back in 2019 with the brilliant musician Ben Folds. I'm thrilled to tell you that Ben now has a podcast of his own. It's called Lightning Bugs with Ben Folds. And you can join Ben as he explores conversations with some of the world's most creative people. His podcast brings guests on for a journey of curiosity through the arts, science, medicine, politics, technology, and more. And each week, Ben creates a new original song with his guest. Maybe you too will get the urge to create something new. Follow, rate, and review Lightning Bugs with Ben Folds on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, wherever you like to listen. You can also subscribe to the Lightning Bugs channel on YouTube and watch their video releases every week. Now back to Southbound and my conversation with Anna Sale. So you mentioned a couple of times about growing up in West Virginia, and you know, your book, besides the death, sex, and money sections, has sections on family and identity, which are also obviously really hard things for many of us mm-hmm. to talk about. Just ask about how you've seen your identity as somebody who grew up in West Virginia, a place that obviously a lot of people have a lot of
ideas about.
Right. Ideas about even people in my experience who grew up there. And so what was your West Virginia like?
Well, first of all, I want to, does West Virginia count as the South for the purposes of this podcast?
It does. It does to me. Okay. I mean, I'm pretty promiscuous with that.
All right.
Texas is in, Oklahoma's everybody, you know. You could argue Missouri for me if you want.
I think you could. Yeah. Okay, good. Expansive. For me, like, I had this very, like, intense, I always felt pride about West Virginia, but I didn't really, I just thought it was like, I'm from a place, and every other person I'm going to meet from a place is probably also proud of where they came from. That was sort of my idea growing up. And for me, it was when I went to college, I left and went to school in California, I went to Stanford, and I was the only kid from West Virginia in my class, which didn't feel like a big deal initially. And then I just, I didn't really get it at the time, but looking back, like, I was really going through some serious culture shock. And I think it was partially that I arrived in Silicon Valley in 1999, was the fall of my freshman year. And it was just like, everybody was talking about how they were making all the money. It was before the first dot-com crash, and it was, and just the visible markers of wealth, and the just like, we're all like, I just had this sort of like, wait, this is strange and unfamiliar to me. And I'm not sure if I buy into this worldview of just like, we all just want to be gazillionaires. Like, is that what it's for, life? So I had this kind of very intense reaction where, because I didn't feel like I fit at Stanford, what do you do when you're 18, 19? You don't feel like you fit. You think, oh, I must fit where I came from, and I'm going to like double down on that identity. So I have this t-shirt that I bought that just has this huge, like, it's like huge logo of, you know, the flying WV for the West Virginia Mountaineers. And it's like cracked and like worn out, but I love that shirt. And I wore it a lot as like, this is who I am. And I like, I did ridiculous things. Like I started a belt buckle collection when I was in college. I like,
I want to hear some examples. Like, what did you?
Well, I had some really good ones. Like, I went to Las Vegas and it was like big Las Vegas with dice. I had another one that was, I got at the Harley Davidson store on a road trip. Like, some really like big ones, which is not really a West Virginia thing, but somehow it was not Stanford. So I leaned into it. And I like, I got really into, you know, bluegrass music, and then I ended up kind of designing. I was a history major. I ended up becoming obsessed with Appalachian history and making, like, I made this one professor do a guided reading with me my senior year about Appalachian history, even though he was a Western United States historian. Like, it was not, it didn't, but he did it with me, which I very much appreciated. So I think what I was trying to sort of work through there was just like, oh, like, there's something really important that I got from West Virginia that I feel super connected to, and how do I understand what it is? And I guess the way I would put words to it now are like, when you grow up in a place that you feel like everybody inside it has a chip on their shoulder, because they are aware that everybody else outside our borders are either not thinking about us, like we don't matter at all, or they're looking down on us. And that's the two options. There's a really intense feeling of camaraderie, of like, we're in this together, you know? Even though, you know, there's a lot of diversity among West Virginians and a lot of things people disagree about, but the sense of like pride and home, and, you know, singing Country Roads arm in arm in Mountaineer Field, like, there's nothing better, you know? So I feel I feel really glad that I have that sense of roots and place. But it has also been complicated in my adult life sense because I went back and I started my radio career in West Virginia and then left in 2008 and haven't lived there since. So what does it mean that I'm from a place that I feel so much fondness for and I feel so close to in a way, and then I chose to leave, I chose to raise my kids elsewhere, I chose to, I'm not sure that I'm giving back in the way that I, all the ways that I could and ought to. So it's something that I feel, I feel this constant pull back because I do feel so proud and glad that I that's my home.
When you were at Stanford and you were doubling down and you were, you know, buying the belt buckles and all that sort of thing, was that from, was there any external trigger for that? Did anybody ever like make fun of where you, where you're from, or, you know, talk crap about you or whatever? Or was it like internally you just feeling like maybe you were an outsider?
I think it was a maybe a little bit of just people making kind of like jokes or something. But mostly, I mean, I can remember my early on, I was at some party and somebody like alluded to knowing what it's like when you turn on the TV on a Sunday afternoon and there's a NASCAR race on. And I was like, oh, will you be my friend? Like, you know, I'm not a NASCAR fan, but like, just that sensory awareness of like, oh, they know something about some part of where I'm from, you know. I just think I felt, I didn't feel like I belonged, which was in a lot of ways really healthy for, you know, an 18, 19 year old kid. It's good to go somewhere where you don't belong and have to learn about lots of different kinds of people. But I remember in particular sort of not feeling really uncomfortable with the ways that Californians in particular had this sense of like, why would you live anywhere else? Like, this is California. We figured it out here. This is the bet, obviously. And I was just like, oh, that's so weird. Like, how, that's like such a not curious way of moving through the world. And also like, there's a lot that's not great about California. So it was kind of this like reactive thing about like people not caring about where I was from that made me care more, rather than feeling, people didn't even know enough to make West Virginia jokes, you know, which is even worse. You know?
Like they didn't have the raw material to make it right. Right. Well, I'm wondering, the reason I ask that question is I think one sort of thread that I see through your work and the interviews you've done is this conflict between internal and external, like how people feel about themselves and how they perceive other people feel about them, or how they perceive other people are feeling versus what those people are really thinking about them inside. And I just wonder if that feels like a classic sort of thing you would be talking about on the show and that sort of thing. And I'm wondering whether any of that was partly a genesis for the kind of stuff you're interested in now.
That's really interesting. I mean, I think, yeah. I mean, I feel like a lot of what I'm interested in my journalism and in life is like ambivalence and mixed feelings and gray areas. And I think that gets at that, you know, internal versus external conflict, and the shoulds of life versus what I feel like I need to do, you know, those tensions and trade-offs. But wait, say more. How do you think the internal and external, how do you think that relates to my West Virginia-ness? I want to understand.
Well, I just wondered whether you were feeling like you were an outsider being from West Virginia, as opposed to how much other people were projecting that onto you. Mm-hmm. You know, whether that's a, you know, it feels like a lot of what you talk about in this book and you talk about on the podcast are sort of perception differences. Mm-hmm. Like once, you know, the sort of key moment in many of the interviews you have is when people, whether they're talking about some earlier conflict in their lives or whatever, is when it gets laid out on the table and somebody says, well, that's not really what I was thinking, or that I thought you thought that, but and I'm overthinking this, I guess, when I'm talking to you about it. But I'm wondering whether that sort of projection that you might have had, that you're at Stanford, you're at this elite university, but you're from West Virginia, and you're carrying that around with you.
Yeah.
You know, that sort of feels like a thing that there would be a podcast about.
Yeah. You know, well, I think the other layer to that, which I write about and think about a lot, is, you know, I think I had maybe more of an accent than, or it came back when I went home.
I didn't have much.
And so I always could sort of move in and out of elite spaces. Like, so that idea of, like, I think that was a big part of the belt buckle phase in college, was like, wait, no one can tell that there's something about me that's different and distinctive and special. And it's about where I'm from, and you can't tell by looking at me. So I'm going to wear, you know, mountaineer t-shirts and belt buckles. And I think that's something I wanted to explore in the, like, talking about identity part of the book, is, like, you know, such a huge part of when we talk about how to talk about identity is, like, that sort of, like, dividing line between, like, are you a person who gets to sort of decide how to disclose who you are? Are you somebody who can very ably sort of code switch and fit and feel belonging, or at least be identified as someone who belongs, and then you can say, here's a way that I'm different? Or are you someone for whom you cannot, you know, control the way the world looks at you and decide certain things about you, and decides whether you belong or not, in it, no matter how you decide to present. So I think for me, just to go back to the West Virginianess, and also kind of being a journalist who works for a New York City-based media company, like, I'm always sort of toying with and thinking about, like, what role am I playing to, like, not just be another coastal media journalist, like, because I can see the world through the eyes of someone who is excluded from all of those narratives, because that's where I grew up. They're excluded.
Yeah, you mentioned in the book, you were talking about community just a minute ago, that obviously, like many of the young people who grew up where you grew up, you left, like most young people do, and most young people.
They all go to Charlotte. Places. That's where they go.
Yeah, that's where we all end up here. That's right. And I think you said it in a really beautiful way in the book, that you've never made a casserole for somebody who's had a death in the family. And I wonder, you know, you've had jobs, obviously, where you've been in different places. You moved more than once for what you've done. And you were just talking about how you kind of are bi-coastal work-wise and move around some now for life. Do you ever have that really real longing to have just stayed put somewhere?
Yeah, I wonder. I don't know if I long for that, but I am very aware of what has been lost, because that hasn't been my life. You know, my mom is from North Carolina and from the eastern part of the state, and you know, almost all my relatives are on that side are still in North Carolina, and most are still in the community where she grew up. And my grandpa was a farmer with his brother, so that's a side of the family that is very connected to place. And you know, I see it on Facebook now because I'm far away from my cousins, but you see that sense of, like, both, you know, continuity and change in one place. You see what it's amazing about having, you know, tons of relatives in one community, that you get to go to the, you know, when I'm in that part of the world, can go to the church where my parents got married. You know, there's just, you know, I know where the graveyard is, where my relatives are. And it's a deep sense of like belonging and identity, that I don't have because, you know, this is kind of morose, but I can remember when I first moved to New York City, part of my, existential adjustment was I would have to walk past this funeral home in Williamsburg, Brooklyn on the way to the grocery store when I would walk to the grocery store. And I would think like, huh, where would my body go if I were mowed over by a bus right now? Like, would it go back to Charleston, West Virginia? Like to the funeral homes where, you know, maybe? Like now my parents have left West Virginia and they're in New Mexico with one of my other sisters. Like, so what would happen? Like, I cannot tell you. And that's like something that's pretty destabilizing to think about, like, where is my resting place and to not know.
I wanted to ask about what it's like for you as being the person who's known as the person who has these hard conversations. And what I'm wondering in particular is, do you get a lot of emails? Do you get messages from strangers, maybe from people you barely know, who, because you have had these intimate conversations for years now on your podcast, feel like they can tell you things or want to tell you things that maybe they haven't told anybody else in their lives? And I wonder how you deal with that. And is it, if that happens, does that become overwhelming to you? And how do you handle it?
That makes me remember, I was at a journalism conference not long after the show started, The Sex and Money, and I remember kind of noticing that people who knew the show, the small talk, the quality of the small talk we had was different. You know, like I remember a woman, I was in the elevator with her and I was like, oh, what do you do? Where are you from? And before the end of the elevator ride, she mentioned that she had gone, had a stillbirth, she had lost a pregnancy and lost a child, which is not something you typically, you know, cover in small talk in an elevator. And it was really intense. And for her and for me, but it was like, I think of that moment as like, whoa, what a privilege to be, to be seen as someone that you can just cut to the chase and say, oh, you really want to know what's going on? Here's what's going on, you know? And I think the thing that I have learned from the show and really try to do when somebody does bring up something that's really sad or really tough or, you know, is just to sit with them in that moment of just, I'm really sorry, and the pain, and not try to come up with some advice or, you know, oh, it's going to get better. Like, you know, I try to just acknowledge what I'm hearing.
At some point, this pandemic is sort of going to end. I mean, it's going to end for different people at different times. I have on my calendar marked when I'm 2 weeks clear of my second shot, you know, and I feel like I'll be like, you know, I feel like being pulled back on a slingshot, you know, that's going to let go at some point. I think for a lot of people, they want this to be, whether it's going to end up being that way or not, sort of a reset point in their lives. Mm-hmm. And I wonder, to sort of wrap up here, if that feels that way for you and if you've thought about how you want your life to be different on the other side of this.
Yeah. I mean, I've thought about it a lot. And I've thought, but I don't really know. That's what I'm trying to be okay with. I feel this, I called one of my friends, one of my dear pandemic friends, who I say I love to now at the end of phone calls. I was talking to him the other day and he said, you know, I just like, I want my life to change. I want something to happen. I don't want to have to do anything. Like he both was exhausted and wanted like an email to pop up in his inbox that changed everything. So right. I think that's how a lot of people feel right now. And so what I am trying to focus on is like, I will also be like a slingshot. And when I am like a slingshot, I am intense because I like want to like connect. Really want to like, I miss people. I want to have social interactions. And I know I'm going to like be clumsy and weird and small talk and overly familiar and disclose things I shouldn't. I'll just be like, because I just want that connection. And I've been trying to like meditate on the idea like of like, I am going to be weird because things are weird. It's not me. It's like the world is weird right now. Like, we don't know how, I don't even know how, what my work is going to look like post-pandemic. I don't know what, you know, we don't know how all of the changes in our economy are going to mean to our communities. We don't know how we're going to integrate what we've learned about the importance of closeness to family during the pandemic, if you've been fortunate to be close, like how, what that's going to mean for the trade-offs that aren't acceptable anymore. Like, there's a lot that is in flux. And so I think that like, that's the thing that I want to like, when I think about the message of the book of Let's Talk About Hard Things, it's about like, it's okay to not have the answers. Like, that's what we should be talking about together. It's like, what are you noticing? What are you noticing about what's different, you know, that you're thinking about? Oh, I'm noticing this too. Like, and then just, it's okay to end the conversation without saying, and therefore I am quitting my job and moving to, you know, an island and, you know, et cetera. Like, I think that that's the impulse that we all have, is we want to present what we figured out. But in fact, a lot is sort of generated when you just sort of compare notes together before you have it figured out or as you're figuring it out, because then you have like a companion or a partner, a friend alongside you while you figure it out.
Anna Sale is one of those people you just want to keep talking to. If it was up to me, this podcast would have been 5 hours long. But even in 5 minutes, she works her magic. She listens, thinks about what you're saying, and tries to connect with you along the way. It's a simple set of tricks. Very few people have mastered them. It feels like most of us could stand to have better conversations, ones where we listen instead of just waiting to talk, ones where we peel back the veneer of our connections and get to the raw wood underneath. I don't know about you, but the pandemic has made me yearn for long conversations with the people I care about, across a table at a coffee shop or on a park bench or under an oak tree somewhere. One of Anna Sale's great gifts to us is that she shows us how to make those conversations possible. And these days, more than ever, those conversations feel necessary. Southbound is a production of WFAE in Charlotte. Our producer is Joni Deutsch. Our main theme music comes from Josh Turner. You can listen to this and other episodes of Southbound on the NPR One app, iTunes, or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can also find Southbound on WFAE.org, where each episode has show notes with more information on that week's guest. See y'all next time. Thanks for listening.